And you were involved in establishing the Friends of the Park some years later?
Yes, yes. The council retained me on several of their committees after I retired, one of them being the advisory committee towards the Botanic Park. And we always had in mind, this is the advisory committee particularly, that they were there to advise, and eventually once the park was established they'd go out of existence. Obviously it's a long process though. But the administration of the park would become a difficult thing without body being organised, and it was felt that that should be set up through the Friends of the Park. And so with that sort of impetus to council, the council agreed to call public meetings to set up the Friends of the Park, which we have done. And we formed a committee and organised the incorporation of a body and established it from there. I happened to somehow fall into the position of chairman of the interim committee and got a Guernsey with the Friends eventually. It's up and running and a very active group. It's going to have a good future. They'll be responsible eventually for a lot of work in the park by volunteer labour, and they'll run a guide service, look after the administration and the management there under guidance of council staff eventually. I would imagine the project will be big enough for the council to appoint a director to operate fully as a botanical park, because it has so much potential in the education field as well as the botanical field. With the fossil finds and the fact that now it's the only location in Melbourne where students can view older basalt flows, and so as all the other quarry holes have been, the older basalt holes have been filled with garbage.
You've always had an interest in the history of the area as you've been working within it.
Mm.
How did you come to record interviews with Norman Beaumont and Gordon Blackburn and people like that?
Well, one of the things I've always found in my working life has been around the fringe areas of Melbourne, the developing areas. You find that there's always a core of people who, by volunteer effort, have virtually carried the old community. Some of them have been councillors of the day, but they've always, their opinions have always been well considered and well sought after, and Berwick was no different. When I first came here, I spoke to first Mayor Barry Simon and said to him, could he suggest to me a list of people whom I ought to talk to get a lot of the old facts, the things you find out about it, where were the old tips that they used, and all this sort of thing. And talking to the old people, you find a lot of these facts on what is on private land in a lot of cases. Danger points you've got to worry about, old land slips and things like this. Old flood records that they would know about, that are not documented anywhere because there was no rainfall data recorded in this area, other than at Narre Warren North by the 69, they received an award from the Australian Met Bureau for the longest privately kept rainfall records. In 69 it was for 104 years. You just don't ignore that sort of information. And so one of the, Barry Simon did was he gave me about three quarters of a fool's cap list of people's names who he thought it would be worthwhile talking to. I started the process of talking to these people to gather information. Unfortunately, I only got down to about eight because we were awfully busy at the time establishing the place. And in part, it got down to when I needed specific type of information, I'd go down his list and find out the most appropriate people to talk to. And I found that, though a number of these were done with individuals on their own, I found the most rewarding way was to get at least two of them talking. they keep reminding each other of different things, and there's some very interesting and funny snippets come out, most unusual things. But the first one was ex-councillor Arthur Robinson, who was several times president of the old Shire. But I got a lot of really valuable information from him on the patterns of flooding, the various creeks and the Dandenong Creek in the area, and these sorts of things. It was just invaluable to us setting up our design procedures for drainage and the like. Of course, the Dandenong Valley Authority were involved, been in existence at that stage for about 10 years, and so they were of great assistance too. And, I gradually accumulated 8 or 9 hours on little tapes of these people, including Norman Bowman, Jack Nabilius, Harold Keyes, George Ray, were the main ones. Norman Beaumont, I put him on a history of Beaconsfield, I think it was, speaking at a Rotary meeting as well one night. So there were a few odd bits and pieces like that that have some value. But I only, it's one of my sorrows that I didn't get through that whole list, because now all of those people have departed over 15 years, and it's a loss of a lot of information.
What was Norman Beaumont like?
A very, because I knew him in his latter years, but a very charming, very nice, real gentle. And he started his book, or it was a combination of several other authors too, but he started the Berwick part of that book when he thought about it in the 50s. His mother was then the last surviving original settler in the district, and so he sat down and talked to her and wrote down all of her memories of the Berwick itself. And when he produced the book, I think it was 1959, the first publication, he involved other writers who had a lot of good information on the other main settlements in the Shire of the day. So the early days of Berwick was produced. When I came here in 73-4, we weren't able to even obtain a copy of the second printing of the book. So a few years later, I had the idea as a Rotary project that we would get it republished, which we did do. And we understand it's the only local history that's ever seen three printings. But anyway, it's still available. I'm still handling the book sales.
How about Gordon Blackburn?
Gordon Blackburn had the Berwick Inn for many, many years. And I'm not sure whether it was Gordon or not, but I'm suspicion it might be. The name was changed from the Border Inn, because that was the border of the police area back in the early days. And he had it, I'm not sure how many years, but I should have checked the history I got him to write. But anyway, I asked Gordon at one stage, I started to ask people such as Norman Beaumont. Norman gave me all his published information, all his photographs, and we photocopied those, and they're now in council's records, and I re-photographed all of his old photographs, and the council have both prints and negatives of those. And so I did the same with Gordon Blackburn, and asked him to write me a history of the Berwick Inn, as he knows it, and he has duly done that. He did that at the time I asked him, plus he loaned me all his old photographs. They've been re-photographed. There are copies of council's records too. So we've done this on a few occasions and been able to reproduce many of the old photographs of the district. They're in the records now.
What was George Ray like?
George was a real live wire for for many, many years he was president of the Benevolent Society and did tremendous work in my time in that area. But George again was a past Shire president from, prior to the formation of the city, lived at Narre Warren North, and I at one stage was trying to find out, we were looking at the construction of Prospect Hill Road, and in the old days it didn't have a western outlet, and on the north side of it were all orchards, and I couldn't have the people going to the Dandenong Market would travel to the east to Narre Warren North Road, then south down Narre Warren North Road, and then come to the Princes Highway and then have to come back up almost past the other end of the street on their way to Dandenong Market. They must have cut through private property. So one day I got George down to see if he could remember. And I taped him telling the stories about how he, just before he went off to the First World War in 1918, how he walked his horses down from Narre Warren North to do the ploughing between all the orchard trees, and his memories of that particular area. So it was an interesting little exercise. But he couldn't remember there being a track going to the west. So I next got Jack Nevelius and Harold Keyes together as the two old identities of Narre Warren. Jack Nevelius has actually been born in a house at the corner of Prospect Hill Road and Narre Warren North Road, but his family moved from there when he was only 4 years of age down to the southern boundary of the Shire, then Shire, or the city now. And his memories were, I can't say they were juvenile, I don't think they existed of the conditions at that time. Harold Keyes was interesting, but none of them could really identify what I thought, and I'm still convinced it was probably happening. They were going through a track in somebody's paddocks to get to the road. Of course, that part's all become the road since. We're just trying to identify where it really originated, as to whether we could legally charge people. That's what we're under the Act at the time.
Coming to some of the main, most significant events over those 15 years. I was wondering if you can recall some of your memories of the Ash Wednesday fires. I understand you were involved in that period.
Yes, sort of memories that don't go away. They're organised for other people to be counselled. You don't seem to get done yourself. But
only what you want to say.
Yes. I've had a bit of experience with bushfires in the past. I actually still remember at the age of about 9, sitting in the Goulburn River when the Black Friday fires went through from Winter Point. So just seeing that at night, just seeing all the hillsides right through the Mantua just blowing. Childhood memory was, well, how could they ever put it out? But in my working time, I had a deal of experience also. In the Doncaster Templestowe area, I went there immediately following the 1962 fires and recognised the problems there and didn't want to get caught again. So if you rang a fire bell at any one of the four recognised areas over there at the time, you could not get a single fire unit out during the day because everybody had commuted to Melbourne. So what we had to do, or what we did do, was set up a firefighting organisation within the council services. Because really, got those fringe areas, you get down to a stage where you're only allowed to have fires at weekends or at night. Because that's the only time the volunteer organisations are available. So, we fortunately had the organisation up and running when the 1984 fires, 1964 fires hit over. What did I say earlier on? Did I say 82 or 62? 62, that's right. When the 1964 fires hit, we had a good organisation running. We put the fires out in that area, and we received considerable criticism because we were doing volunteer people's work. But the volunteer people couldn't get out on the ground until after 4 o'clock, and we'd been fighting fires from 11 a.m. in the morning. That was the sort of scene. When I came out here, we were better off because our volunteer units here, there were enough people in the community. And one of the things that council approved of us doing was to encourage members of our staff to become members of the volunteer brigades locally. So that we've always been in a position here that the volunteer brigades were available, or that there were enough available. And we had an arrangement that if any of them felt short of manning a unit at any time, they could ring us and we'd immediately run staff, experienced staff, up to help man the units. As well as that, we organised all of the brigades and had an annual meeting here every year before the fire season. The Shire had a tanker which we took over, and we had a couple of loose ones that went onto the back of trucks. But one of our big problems in those early years was that even Heatherton Road was unsealed. And of course, to use the tanker there, it would spend only about 30% of its time watering, 70% of its time filling up and running backwards and forwards the flows of water. So what we did was bought a second-hand petrol tanker, had it degassed, and made that into a very big water tanker, plus putting a very good pumping unit on it. And so it became a reservoir, and with council's approval, it was available if they contacted me to go anywhere in the region. Well, we're involved with 3 firefighting regions, but they could any of them call on us in emergencies. And that vehicle acted as a real reservoir for could handle about 4 units pumping out of it, in actual fact. And we could cope with any big house fire or similar fires. It became invaluable in severely bushfires that let up. On Ash Wednesday, of course, we spotted the fire. That background was necessary to understand that we had a really good understanding with all of the brigades, and if they wanted our equipment, it was there, and we would modify our equipment all the time to their suggestions. When they got improved equipment, we'd upgrade and update our stuff so that they could use it. Come Ash Wednesday, we actually spotted the fire from the offices here, and I checked on the radio to see who was nearest, and one of our senior biologist officer at the time, Norm Steele, was nearest to that area, and he went in and immediately radioed back that he had a woman and a boy, I think it was, in a car that had been burned, and they were requiring hospitalisation. So naturally, of course, we got an ambulance on the move for that, but pretty obvious from the conditions of the day that it was going to be a bad one, so I immediately got on the telephone to the Doveton brigade, because that was the manned station. We used that setup consistently where we spotted fires initially. What brigades in, they were quickest off because they didn't have to assemble people unless they were already here. At that stage, on Ash Wednesday, they were involved, the region was involved in 8 fires in the region before this one got up. So I said, right, we kept an open line until such time as he could, from region, get us some units assigned. We had all of our men assembled, the tankers filled. We had 2 tankers at that stage, the big one and a smaller one. And once they had units assigned, they went into King Road by that stage, and we saw the smoke up north of Narrewarra North, and by the time Norm Steele reported in, he was up on about the deviation, I think, of Narre North Road. By the time we got units assigned, they went into King Road, and the big tanker went in there with them. The little tanker followed the next assigned units in, and he finished up down at Officer. So that's how fast the fire went right through that stage. Would have only required a 4-degree wind shift to have in fact taken out Harker Way and taken the north end of Berwick out. missed both, and missed Beaconsfield at the time. Once it got out of the timber and down onto the ground in, I've got Mount Misery and all of that area, down on the ground, their officer able to get a handle on it. But what happened from there was that the brigades moved into Acuna Park to use that as their assembly point. The police followed them for the trial. And so everybody was assembling in Acuna Park. And there was a wind change occurred about 9 o'clock at night, and that was what did the damage, because we had about 10 miles of fire that had run through the area with the flanks still smouldering away. And this incredible wind change came through and just took it to the northeast, threw up a Beaconsfield, and my recollection from the boys on the radio to me trying to keep a handle on it was that just up a Beaconsfield just exploded. Earlier during the afternoon, we'd been concerned about it all, so we took precautions with requests from Upper Beaconsfield. We put trucks in and actually evacuated the couple of old people's homes up there. We actually evacuated and brought them down to the Catholic Hall on the highway. And I was trying to, at that stage, get beds and things like this for them. That was pretty difficult, but we managed to get the Seventh Day Adventists in, and they came in with their equipment, and they were very helpful that way. By about 9 o'clock at night, I could see there was a problem. We had Jeff Marjoram down at Keener Park on the 2-way radio. Every major point that we were concerned about, I had a fairly senior officer in the vehicle with the 2-way radio, so that we weren't getting an assessment all the time as to what was best to do. It became pretty obvious by 9 o'clock that there was no way that everybody assembling to go into the fires, of course, at Acuna Park, it blocked the highway, which meant that you couldn't bring anybody out from Upper Beaconsfield onto the highway. So we got officers down, and we diverted people off at Inglis Road, and I had Jeff go down. I had to get somebody else eventually to get keys, that's right. But we opened the Ferret Leisure Centre, organised gym mats to go out and things like that, and started to bring people in there. And by the next morning, that just developed into an incredible situation. We're feeding people there, we're getting clothing and stuff in, trying to clothe them. Fortunately, the Anglican minister came in early, but we had, because people with family losses and things like this at that stage, we had to have people camp and council. By mid-morning, we got all the community services running. And we had the staff, more than half the staff were here down. And so it got into full flight, and we, for over 2 days, we just took it in turns between the four of us, between that northeast, Neil Regis, Ross Curry and myself, to run that place for several days. The councillors came in, got on phones and all sorts of things. We had marvellous backup. We even had people like Myers and Coles who lent us some clothing racks and this sort of thing. Because the people who we were dealing with, they were all in shock. We put members of the staff on to go around with them, and they had to think for them. This is when the first time people started to put a handle on what the real effects are of these sorts of disasters. Because people were not, it wasn't a matter of, you know, giving them something to wear today. It was Dad had to go to work on Monday. You know, what did he do? What should he wear for work? And so they were clothing people, because a lot of people had lost everything. One of the other interesting things was that after it all, we did an analysis, because we also ran the cleaning up, and everything was put into a new landfill site, or a destroyed timber and houses and car bodies and things. We put them into there. The government paid, compensated for the loss of land. But we did an analysis, and that's all in the council's records, of tonnages you can expect to happen with a disaster. An average of 4 car bodies per household. All these sorts of things. From memory, it was 64,000 tonnes of burned building and vehicles that were buried up there. An average of 8 truckloads. And that's trucks and the dog trailer behind it, the quarrying ones. Mainly because of the nature of the material, you know, long bits of timber. Mm-hmm. Nothing stacks easily. Burnt iron was. And of course, the stuff doesn't tip. We finished up hiring originally from the railways. And the crane they had with a special grab, there's only about 2 of them in the state. And that was the only way to unload the trucks. You had to unload them, couldn't tip them. Or little things that you can pick up in an emergency. But the next day, I drove the area. I couldn't get a real picture on the ground. And we had the DVA in-house and the officers who looked at the time, so they said. They booked a plane a couple of weeks before, because they fly their drones once a year, and they said, "So we've got a plane booked for today. You can take it over, as long as you take a couple of their fellows up." So I took Pat Northeast up and myself, DVA fellows, Cessna. It was the roughest ride I've ever had in a light plane. I've had a lot of rides, purely but simply because of the thermals caused by the hot spots on the ground. And the obvious problem was that the area was really about 30% burned out. It was 60 or 70% that was all scorched, which meant the big danger was with the wind change, getting a burn back. And of course, nobody, there was nothing left in area. Nobody had water, it had all been used up. So we got a fleet of tankers from the Metropolitan Municipality, 7 of them loaned us their street flushers and tankers. And we had a person in charge of each one, and they went into every property between Harkaway and Cockatoo, including Cockatoo. And in 3 days we put in over 250,000 gallons of water into household tanks and swimming pools so that there was resource there. Fighter fire should have burned back. The other interesting thing with Ash Wednesday is it's the first fire of that nature anywhere in Australia that's ever been put out by human intervention. We actually stopped the fire. Every other major fire in the past has been put out by a wind, weather change with rain. And I put it down to better equipment, better communications, and better coordination. A lot of lessons learned.
Was there any rethinking of your prevention procedures after that?
Well, a lot of things that we'd been doing informally started to become formal, and we had established in fire mapping procedures that which were done right through the fringe areas of Melbourne. Per the Board of Works at the time, their involvement in planning at that stage in other logical ways. So that with advice from CFA, etc., we set up fire mapping procedures and identification of zones, which are still in vogue, are still in use, and a lot of good work done on training programs for people, particularly through the Mount Macedon Centre. One of the best things I think that ever happened was that they also were influenced by the fire, lost some of their buildings. But their people up there saw the role that local government played in the fire and recognised that nobody else could handle the coordination but local government. And so they converted all their courses and disaster courses and backed it. And this is why local government now in fact plays the major role in coordinating. The police in charge to be able to enforce things, and but the local councils in every case now in the state, and there's been a complete state network and plan established based around those things. But thumbnail sketch.
Do you have any recollections of a few years later of the 150 celebrations in Berwick, or then the bicentennial celebrations?
Oh yes, we had. They were sort of the usual things, you know, parades, everybody gets behind them and gets involved, and they're a great day or two for the community.
You contributed a lot of the photos for the bicentennial exhibition, didn't you? They were ones.
Yes, yes, these are a lot of the ones that are now in council's records, this type of thing. I wrote a history of roads in this part of Victoria, publication for school projects and that sort of thing. A few odd things.
Do you want to say something about the people you worked with in the city of Berwick over the years? I'm thinking of the other chief administrative staff, but also the people that worked under you in your section.
Oh, yes. We had a great team, and I put that down to your council initially appointed Pat and myself, and then they also did the interviews for the other senior staff that accepted our advice on what we thought at the interviews. Having achieved that, the council agreed with the point that we expressed that people below that level ought to be appointed at officer level and handled that way, so that it wouldn't be a big issue if people proved not to be satisfactory. And that system worked very well, and I must pay due credit to the council. It's very unique in that it's one of the few councils, it only happens once every 10 or 15 years in local government, that a new municipality is started from totally from scratch by a severance. And we were lucky that the majority was Greenfields as well, but we were able to say to council that we believe the right approach is that you appoint your senior staff, effectively your executive staff, to do the administration itself. Council is there to make the policies, and the final decisions, rightfully in many areas, legislation-wise. But really, it's there for, you know, you're there as the policy makers, and what we need is good, sound policies. And then the officers do the administration, and the council follow that extremely well, and the city has functioned, I believe, very, very well because of it. We have a tremendous team of the people who were appointed, and that remained unchanged for quite some time, I think.